Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast adventure to discover the entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join us on tonight's episode when my guest Will describes what marriage meant to his grandmother.
Her wedding present was a shotgun and a goat.
The topic is Shakespeare's Sonnet 20, a love poem written to another man. What are the things you're not telling people, and what's stopping you? My guest this week is Will Costakis, author of award-winning young adult novels and the upcoming book, The Sidekicks. Growing up, Will and his best friend were as close as friends could be, or at least they told themselves they were. There was something neither one was telling the other, and now never will. Big thanks to everyone supporting the Sewers of Paris on Patreon. If you're enjoying the show, you can help keep it independent and ad-free with your pledge of support. Just go to sewersofparis.com and click support the show on Patreon. And if you've got a minute, a review would be super helpful as well. Head over to sewersofparis.com. There's a link right at the top of the page for writing a review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks to Marsha LC, who writes, almost every episode, the guests say something like, "Phew, thanks for this. It was like a therapy session." That does happen sometimes, and what you don't know is that I'm billing all of my guests $200 an hour. Just kidding. I do love to hear from listeners. The show's at Sewers of Paris on Twitter and Facebook, or you can write to sewerspodcast@gmail.com. Also, if you're in Seattle, I hope you'll join us for another Dungeons & Drag Queens show. We have four fabulous drag queens on stage for one night only, role-playing their way through a custom-made, very queer Dungeons & Dragons adventure. It's happening October 25th at 7 p.m. at the Timber Room, and you can get tickets to Dungeons & Drag Queens at strangertickets.com. Now, here's Will. Well, this week I'm speaking to Australian writer Will Costakis. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, no, thank you so much for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
It's Shakespeare's A Woman's Face. Have you heard of it?
No.
I think it's Sonnet 120. And basically, I was this closeted gay boy in the back of my grade 9 English classroom. And we'd sort of run out of things to study in English. So in the final 2 weeks, my teacher was just giving us Shakespearean sonnets to read. And she came to hand out this sonnet. You know how when you're in high school and you're reading a poem for the first time, you have no idea what on earth it means. And you wait for the teacher to sort of explain it. But as we were reading this one as a class, I sort of had an inkling of what it was about. And it was William Shakespeare writing about sexual attraction to a man and understanding that was frowned upon by society or that it wouldn't quite work out. And so I'm in the back of my English classroom just quietly losing my mind over this.
A woman's face with nature's own hand painted. Hast thou the master, mistress of my passion? A woman's gentle heart, but not acquainted with shifting change as is false woman's fashion.
And I went to an all-boys school, and back then it was quite conservative. And I was sitting there, you know, wondering how the class would react to it, because I had it in my head that, like, right, I couldn't come out and be a writer. I had to sort of stay in the closet because back then, this was early 2000s, if someone came out, it was a public spectacle and sort of a scandal. And so I thought if I wanted to be a professional writer, I would have I had to keep that part of my life secret. And as we read that out in class, I saw a future for myself. You know, kids asked questions and they were quite sort of okay with it, which was nice. And then my teacher explained we didn't know whether Shakespeare was writing about his own experience or whether he was just commissioned to write it for someone else. But in Australia especially, there's this sort of fear of reading gay texts even now in schools, and I thought that it would somehow impede on my career to come out and to write for young adults. But the wonderful thing was William Shakespeare is read widely across the country and across the world. And I knew then that if William Shakespeare could consider same-sex attraction possibly in his life, but definitely in his work, then there was a path forward for me. And it sort of opened the world up for me.
how much of your future had you planned out at that point? Because it sounded like you already had sort of a lock on writer for young adults.
Yeah, I was one of those kids. You know, when you meet those really annoyingly determined kids that you just hate, I was one of those that just sort of, I had everything planned out. Like, to give you an idea, I was bitterly disappointed that I wasn't an author by 12 years old. And it was like,
why was it
myself,
so important?
I don't know. It was... So I grew up under a lot of financial stress at home. Mum was a single mum, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to write a book and it's going to be massive. And, you know, then all our financial, you know, worries will evaporate. And that didn't quite happen. But I was still sort of determined to, you know, help my family out however I could. And, you know, to the point where when I got a book deal in my senior year of high school, I thought I'd somehow failed them by not, you know, getting a book deal sooner. But I was just one of those kids.
Okay, well, let's... we've got a bunch to unpack here.
Yeah, I know. It's just... It's really funny to think about now. But
so
I was just one of those...
What did you want to write about?
Well, look, you know, if you read my earlier work, I clearly had no idea what I wanted to write about. I can see myself sort of working through, you know, the things that influenced me growing up, or the things that shaped me. So you have, you know, my parents' divorce, sorry, you know, they were... Most people are really committed to making a strong marriage. My parents were really committed to having a really strong dynamic divorce. So that was a process that lasted a very, very long time and was incredibly bitter. And I just loved writing about it and sort of poking fun at it and just, you know, school life. But all of the things that I wrote about, there wasn't really a point to it. It was just, I was writing loose memoir, but, you know, it was just very long-winded and there was no real point or plot. And now that I look back at it, I realize, okay, that's why I wasn't an author at 12. You know, I had no idea what the stories were that I was telling. And as I grew up...
So you were writing, like, comedically about your parents' divorce?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, very comedically. Like, it's to the point where, you know, if you read sort of... I still have... My first novel that I wrote when I was in grade 7, if you read through it, it is so chock full of the most inappropriate, vile humor that I'm certain we wouldn't let children read it. But it's really funny that I actually wrote it as a child. I don't know. I was always encouraged by the people around me to find the humor in everything. And that was whether it was a coping mechanism or whether I just had a really dark sense of humor. I was always attracted to finding the worst in things and... then finding the joke.
What other things did you write about besides your, like, this? It sounds like it was a really stressful divorce.
So for me, it was really looking at that sort of, you know, growing up in that single parent household. But then between grades 10 and grades 11, my biggest supporter, you know, my best friend who read all of my writing and who, you know, we had sort of grand plans. I was going to be a world famous author and he was either going to be... my agent or my biggest groupie, and we would tour the world until we ended up in the same nursing home, making the same tired jokes we were making in high school. He actually passed away, and in an instant, the trajectory of my life changed. I lost that sort of shared future that we had imagined for each other. And I notice instantly, if I look through my writing that I still have recorded and saved, there's a distinct shift, and suddenly... I became really preoccupied with mortality and, you know, writing was a way for me to deal with that shock and to deal with, you know, the fact that no tomorrow is guaranteed. And, you know, I can see myself in my writing sort of maturing, and that's when my writing, I sort of started to find a point to everything, if that makes sense. My writing became less wishy-washy, less meandering. And I had a particular focus, and I wanted to look at how death sort of shapes people and how we fear it, but also it inspires us.
That's a lot to try to wrap your head around when you're a teenager.
I still don't think I've wrapped my head around it now.
Was your friend's death, was it very abrupt?
It was very abrupt. So it was the product of a drunken accident. So it was very much like everything was... normal, and then suddenly it wasn't, and the world was turned on its head.
So how do you start to make sense of something that that really is senseless.
Well, we did. It started with inappropriate jokes, and that was sort of how, you know, when he was around, that was how we would deal with things. And so we started by joking about it. I distinctly remember his funeral was one of the strangest, funniest experiences of my life, because I don't know if you ever had the misfortune of attending a teen funeral, but this particular one, it was almost like it was a competition. It was like high school on steroids. Suddenly we're all competing over who's going to be looked upon as his closest friend. And it was actually, I wrote a scene based on that, and that was what got me my first book deal when I was in high school. And it was just narrating his funeral as a sporting event where the grievers were fighting over who was the better friend and receiving scores, and it was narrated like a sporting event. It started with that sort of humor, and if you read my first book that I wrote when I was 19, and it was still quite raw for me, I don't sort of deal with the real emotions of it. I make the quick jokes and I sort of move on. And I always told myself that I wanted to write a story about him and about us, but I didn't think I was good enough. I think a lot of writers and a lot of creatives have that voice in the back of their head that tells them, oh no, you're not good enough for this project yet. And so I put it off and I put it off and I put it off. And then a couple of years ago, I visited his house to visit his mum, and I saw his photo on the fridge and I realized, oh, I'd forgotten what he'd look like. And so I knew then that I had to actually write, you know, the story that had been bottled up. And so it's only recently that I've gone back and really started to unpack and sort of seen how his death affected my life, and also gone back to those sort of raw emotions and what it was like to live through that sort of intense emotional period and that intense upheaval when I was still in high school.
It's funny, the things that you don't realize that you have bottled up until you sort of uncork them, and then you're like, oh, I've been carrying that around with me?
Yeah. That's the really wonderful thing about being a writer. You know, I save so much on therapy bills. I just get out a blank document and I'm like, okay, what's in here? And then by the end of it, it's like, oh, maybe I do need that therapist.
Well, it sounds like you were sort of guided to that by passages like that sonnet.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, it's a poem and it's very nice and the class is studying it, but for you, it sounds like you saw something in there that maybe it was the author's intent or maybe not, but what do you remember from that sonnet? Like, how did you know that it was about men appreciating each other?
Oh, it's very obvious. So it's just, you know, it's Shakespeare saying, oh, you know, you have the face of a woman and I'm attracted to you because of that. So it's very obvious that he's talking about same-sex attraction. And the really funny thing was, though, that my friend that passed away was also closeted, and we both were quite afraid to come out, and he passed away before he could come out to me. And that was obviously one of the things that inspired me to write The Sidekicks, because, you know, it's such an absolute waste to spend your life in the closet because you don't know how much time you have. And so, you know, I'm lucky enough to be able to come out in my mid-20s and still hopefully live a very full life as an out gay man. But he didn't get that same opportunity, and that fear sort of stifled him. And, you know, we absolutely wasted the time that we had together being afraid of, you know, each other and expecting the worst of each other and not realizing what was quite plain for everyone around us, that we were two of the gayest people to ever walk the earth. I still, you know, I'll sit here and I'll talk about that poem as if it, you know, it was a huge awakening for me, and it was, but at the same time I was sitting next to him, and this was 2 years before he died, and I still said nothing to him and he still said nothing to me. So not only does that poem sort of remind me of, okay, this is who I am and this is who I will be and that's okay, it also reminds me of the fact that I didn't take the opportunity that was in front of me when I could have. And, you know, sometimes I imagine how different my life would have been if we'd actually opened up to each other and spoken to each other, I would have obviously felt less alone. But, you know, can't change that now. I can only sort of reflect on it in fiction.
So how did you eventually take that opportunity? Like, when did you start coming out?
Oh, this is a long storied history. Basically, one of my friends moved away to London. And I was like, righto, okay, this is great. This is, I can come out to him, you know, the night before he leaves. And if it doesn't go well, it's fine. And so I came out to him and it was fine. Then he left and I didn't tell anyone else for quite a while. It just got to the point where I had a policy where, you know, at first it was, oh no, if someone asks a question about sexuality, you just deny it. Or, you know, you use, when you're talking about a partner, always make sure you use the opposite pronoun, things like that, just to be very careful and hide it. And as I grew up, I sort of grew weary of that. And so the things changed. Instead of using a female pronoun, I would use a gender neutral pronoun. And then if they quizzed me on it, I made a vow in about my early 20s. I was like, okay, I'm no longer going to lie about this. If they ask me the question or if they ask me specifics, then I will tell them. You know, I started telling more people that way. And then it sort of culminated in sort of, I built it up to sort of coming out to my mum, and I had no idea, you know, when you sort of build it up in your head that it's going to be this really big, horrific experience. And, you know, my mum had already sort of dealt with my older brother coming out. So it really should have been easy for me. I had a blueprint for it and I'd seen what had happened before, and, but I'd still feared it. And then
what were you afraid of?
Oh, you know, I have a very Greek mother. She thinks she's not, but she's still very, very Greek. And, you know, I imagined a lot of dramatics and crying and, oh, my son has chosen the harder path in life. Wah, wah, wah. That sort of thing. I never feared outright rejection, but I still feared something. And I remember I was sitting there and my mum, she was like, Will, I need to talk to you. I'm like, yeah. She's like, oh, you know, tell me, I don't want any surprises. Are you gay? And I'm like, okay, cool. She's asked the question. I just come out and I say, yeah, I do. I like men. And she sighs and she's like, okay, give me a minute. Give me a minute. She exhales and then she just relaxes and she looks at me. She's like, you know what? I always thought your father was a bit of a poof. And then we both just lose it laughing. And, you know, I'd built up this sort of scary, you know, confrontation scene in my head. But really, this was what I should have expected from it. My mum using it to take a casual dig at my dad, which was very much on brand for her. And it really was, you know, what I should have expected. But that's the thing. When you're in the closet, you sort of expect the worst of everyone around you. You know, sometimes that worst is justified and people live up to those horrible expectations, but, you know, sometimes they don't and they surprise you. It's like, you know, I always use the story of my Greek grandmother. So in Australia at the moment, we're having this really horrible marriage equality debate and it's the worst. Have you seen it in the news?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So if it's not even a vote, it's like, so our parliament has the power to pass it quite easily, but they don't want to sort of own the decision. So they have a non-binding postal survey where the entire nation, everyone who's eligible to vote in general elections, can sort of select yes or no on this, should same-sex marriage, you know, be legalized. And, you know, obviously they're, you know, taking a leaf out of, you know, the Prop 8 sort of handbook, and they're making it all about kids in schools and things like that, and destroying gender and whatever. It's quite a really horrible debate. And I think back to my grandmother who, you know, her wedding present back in the day on, you know, the Greek mainland, her wedding present was a shotgun and a goat. They shot the goat, ate the goat, and then smuggled the shotgun into Australia when they moved here. And, you know, that's her sort of, that was what marriage was for her, you know, what, 60, 70 years ago. And my mum sort of told her, she's like, hey, you know what, your grandchildren are gay and that's cool. And my grandmother sort of goes off to a Greek monastery in the mountains of mainland Greece and goes to visit a priest. And she thinks us being gay is her fault. So she goes to confession and she talks to the priest and she's like, oh, you know, my grandsons are gay. And the priest just says, yes, and she's like, I'm here to confess. And he's like, well, you know, are your are your grandkids good people? And she says, yes. And he's like, do you love them? And she says, yes. And he's like, well, then they're gifts from God. And the funny thing is now that my grandmother in her 80s is more progressive than the country that she emigrated to, which is startling and frightening, but also sort of heartening, because you know that equality, whether it be marriage or just equal rights in general, it's an easy thing to convince someone to believe in.
Yeah, I mean, increasingly, I think, you know, a few years ago would have been a lot. I think that's when talk of the plebiscite in Australia started,
yeah,
when it seemed like a bit less palatable for a politician, yeah, to support the freedom to marry. And now it just feels like a relic that they, yeah, the leadership just won't get rid of.
But the really funny thing is that it's a relic from 2004. Like, it was never illegal to marry someone of the same sex. It's just no one ever sort of tried it. But then they added in this sort of clause that says you can't get married unless the celebrant says that marriage is between a man and a woman to the exclusion of all others. So they added in that definition of marriage in 2004, funnily enough, without a postal survey.
Oh,
Yeah. Funny how that works.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds like, all things considered, you had a fairly smooth coming out. Like, there were maybe some things that you had anxiety about, but when you actually did it, It seemed like you're fairly welcomed. How did that compare with the future that you envisioned that first time you saw that Shakespearean sonnet?
See, that's the thing, though. It was really smooth with the people around me in terms of the queer community when I came out as an author who was gay, because that's the thing. I started out as sort of the young author. I was on the circuit at 19, and then I reinvented myself as I wrote this sort of super Greek book about my grandmother and all that sort of stuff. So I suddenly became the young Greek author. And then after I came out, then it sort of things happened. So I had expected, you know, okay, my family's okay with it. My close friends are okay with it. The industry will be fine with it. And a big part of being an author in Australia is touring schools and speaking at schools and things like that. And I had a school that I'd previously spoken at cancel the launch party that they wanted to do for the Sidekicks, because I had come out on my blog in an article. And they thought, oh, okay, this book likely won't be appropriate for high school readers. And it became this huge news story in Australia, at least for the 24-hour cycle, and I had a lot of pushback from a lot of schools in Australia are religiously affiliated, and there was this huge sort of pushback from it. And this was only at the beginning of last year. There was this really weird sort of discussion of what's the appropriate amount of discussion about homosexuality that we can have with teenagers. And so all those fears that I had about coming out affecting my career, they were realized then. And it was really funny, because the same schools that really pushed me to talk about my Greek identity and that really, really pushed me to talk about my grandmother and, you know, talk about being, coming from a migrant family, were suddenly very, very against me talking about anything other than the books, because my identity shouldn't impact my speeches. And so that irony was not lost on me. But the really funny thing is, for every school that pushed back against me or cancelled an event, I had three or four that came up and said, you know, and tried to book me. And so after a very scary sort of hostile February, by March, everything was great. And, you know, the Sidekicks went on to become my fastest selling novel. So I was embraced eventually, but there was a very slight scary bump in the road.
So let's talk about the books that you wrote, starting with that one when you were 19. Oh. What was that book, and how did you get the attention of a publisher?
Oh, so this is, they always get mad when I tell my how I got published story. So I kept sending it off to publishers. They kept saying no. But as I got older and older, their replies became nicer and nicer and nicer. And then in year 12, I had so many rejection emails that I decided, okay, I'm going to guess publishers' email addresses and then pitched directly to them. And so I guess their email addresses sent them off this email pitching my book to them. But as I was writing the email, I changed the pitch and the premise and I sent it off to them and then, you know, expecting the publisher to get back to me in like 6 months. But they got back to me within the day saying, we'd love to read it. And so I freaked out, hurriedly wrote a first chapter, sent it off. And they're like, oh, great. Can you come in next week and bring the whole book with you? And I'm like, oh, I have not written this book and I'm a senior in high school. So I freaked out. I sort of rushed a couple of chapters. They read them and they said, oh, well, we really don't like these new chapters, but we love the book. How about we just give you some money and some time and you write this book for us? And so the next year I wrote the book and the following year it came out when I was 19. So that was a book called Loathing Lola. It was about a group of high school students who had their own reality TV show. And so it was really looking at, you know how like in the mid 2000s, it looked like reality TV was dying. Like you had sort of the 10th season of Big Brother and people had stopped sort of watching it, and or at least in Australia. And it sort of looked like, okay, we're going to go back to scripted programming. We're over this sort of reality TV stuff. And I was sort of looking at those sort of dying breaths of reality TV. And then, you know, 3 years later, it was back with a vengeance. But I was really looking at what it would, how teenagers would deal with the sort of scrutiny of the public watching their every move and producers sort of manipulating them. So it was like the Babysitter's Club meets the Truman Show sort of thing. But you could very much tell that an 18-year-old boy wrote it. And I was like, right, okay, what should my next book be? And I was really stuck. And because my first book didn't exactly, you know, set the nation on fire, I was like, okay, my next book might be my last chance at this. And so I really thought about it, really considered it. And I knew I wanted to reflect on my family and sort of write about what it was like to grow up in a small but potent Greek family. And so that ended up culminating in a book called The First Third, which is basically what if my quirky Greek grandmother gave me her bucket list when I was in senior year of high school. So imagine the most inappropriate bucket list a Greek grandmother could, you know, create. Things like find your mother a husband, un-gay your older brother, make your younger brother not a shithead. And so sort of, and it was, you know, what if a senior in high school had to complete his grandmother's dying wishes. And so that became The First Third. And then finally, The Sidekicks, which is my American debut. It's about a group of four guys, but they're not four best friends. They're three guys with the same best friend. And then that best friend passes away. And it's all about what the three remaining guys, the swimmer, the rebel, and the nerd, what they do to sort of rebuild their lives and eventually trace a path back to each other. And so that was really looking at, you know, my best friend's death and how it shaped my life, but also how it could have shaped the lives of those around me and sort of, but it's all fictionalized.
So these all seem very autobiographical. Even going back to that first one about the reality show, I mean, did you feel as though, I don't know, like, did you feel as though reality show, like, why was that a focus for you? Why was that something on your mind?
I was always really interested in TV, and this was just before. So we had in Australia, I know that some other countries had sort of Bebo and then we went onto Facebook and stuff. But in Australia, it was very much, we had MySpace and then it became sort of Facebook. And this is, so MySpace had only just sort of started and I was starting to see that whole performative aspect, you know, to teen lives. And I wondered, okay, what if that was amplified with a TV show? How would that change the way that we acted? How would that change the way that we lived our lives? So it was a way for me to reflect on sort of the greatest hits of my life. So my friend passing away, my parents' divorce, and all the funny stuff that had ever happened in high school that I recorded in diaries. And I thought, okay, what if all of that played out in front of a reality TV camera? And so It was something that I was taught when I was in the first grade that has sort of stuck with me for such a long time. And my teacher always said that if you ever want to turn your real life into a story, what you do is you take your real life and you ask, what if? And so I took my real life and my what if question was, what if I had a reality TV show? And obviously through the drafting process, you know, that went from being very, very autobiographical to being something that I could connect with, but that was still very, very fictional. And that's sort of the sweet spot that I try to hit with my books, where I'm familiar with everything that I'm writing about and I've felt it in my life, but it's still very, very fictional.
Did it feel, you said the performativeness of being a teenager, I think that's something that a lot of queer kids are kind of familiar with, is like having to put on a show and perform and be like, oh no, gay? Me? No, not at all. Like, was that something that you felt like? Were you aware of kind of putting on a straight show?
Oh yeah, completely. You know, you never mention the kind of music you listen to, the books that you like, the TV shows that you like, for fear of someone calling you a name. You're always very aware of how limp your wrists are in public or your turns of phrase. And there is that sort of, you build a wall around yourself and you sort of, you would rather be boring than be seen as something that's different. And, you know, I definitely felt that. And it's, what's really, really funny is, you know, I was, I won a writing prize in grade 11, which was the Sydney Morning Herald Young Writer of the Year. And I went back and I had to sort of, I was interviewed by the Sydney Morning Herald. And if you look back at some of the articles, one of them, I made up a girlfriend to talk about. And that was just the worst. And like, I'm reading it now as an adult going, this is not convincing at all. But, you know, I felt like this was, I'd achieved something I'd always wanted. Yeah. I'd won a really huge writing prize in Sydney. And yet the first thing that I thought of to talk about was this fake girlfriend. And that's the thing. It's sort of, you know, when you're in the closet, you know, there's always that, oh, you know, being gay will somehow diminish this. And so the first thing that I did, I had to sort of protect that idea that, you know, I was straight and I'd won this award. Winning the award wasn't good enough, or winning the award and being gay would have somehow been a bad thing.
Well, and you mentioned the difficulty that you faced once you did come out. For some people, it was kind of a bad thing. For the schools that were like, no, we don't want you to come anymore, we don't want you to talk about this. How did you receive that news? Like, how did they... I can't even imagine somebody saying to you, oh no, never mind, don't come, you're gay.
Yeah, that's the thing. They never say that specifically. It's always, oh, you know, we wonder if it will be appropriate for the teens, but they never actually say what it is. And it's always dancing around the point, which is really sort of interesting. But, you know, I don't know what it's like over there, but if I visit a Catholic school in Australia, a lot of the times I have to sign an agreement that says I will not talk about anything that isn't in keeping with the teachings of the Catholic Church. And especially at the moment, a lot of members of the church are very anti anything that isn't 100% heteronormative. And I received it. At first, I was quite shocked and, you know, I was quite, you know, upset, because this was a school that knew my product. They knew what I did. You know, my whole reason for visiting schools is to inspire teenagers to write. Those who don't like writing, you know, hopefully to make it a little easier for them. And those that do, hopefully to, you know, fan that spark into a fire and to inspire them to read. And yet I was being reduced to my sexuality, like I was going to walk up there and, you know, give a detailed explanation of how to have gay sex. And, you know, it was really weird because they reduced me to my sexuality. And it was really sort of difficult to navigate for a while, because I went from being the go-to speaker in my city to suddenly being, you know, this radical queer who was out to convert kids. And so it was really difficult to shake that at first. But the funny thing is, now I have schools that approach me to sort of talk about queer issues, because, you know, if you're going to look for the most empathetic person in a school, it's usually the librarian. And, you know, they see queer kids who go to the library for refuge, for shelter, and, you know, for a safe space. And they often encourage me to talk about this sort of stuff with the teenagers. And, you know, yes, you are talking to them about, you know, the gay experience and, you know, kids who are straight, you know, get a lesson in empathy, but you're really doing it for that questioning kid or that gay kid or that curious kid, you know, so that they know that there is a path forward to them, so they can see themselves in someone else and know that it's okay.
Was there ever a point at which you regretted coming out or wish you'd been a little more, I don't know, secretive about it?
At first, yes. And for a lot of the initial sort of, you know, storm that this inspired, definitely. But, you know, I come back to the fact that, you know, my friend that died, you know, was in the closet as well. And we wasted the time that we had together because we didn't trust each other. And I can't change that now because I'm grown and he's gone. But if I can somehow change that for future generations, then I will try to, because this is a horrible thing to live with. But look, me coming out sort of, you know, it wasn't the only thing that I sort of started to get this blowback when I wrote a queer character in the first third, but I was still closeted at the time. And I remembered I went into a school and it was grade 10 girls had just read the book and they were studying it and they were being asked, they wanted to host basically a Q&A with me. And so they would ask me questions about the book, I would answer it. And so near the end of the session, you know, the teacher had come up to me earlier and just said, "Oh, Will, don't talk about the gay character in the book," which is kind of strange because, you know, he's one of the most pivotal characters. He's the best friend of the protagonist and was basically my author surrogate in the text. And so I didn't talk about him until the end of the talk when I asked them, "Oh, who's your favorite character?" And I expected the students to say the funny Greek grandmother or whatever. And this girl puts up her hand and she goes, "Oh, I really like the gay character." And I'm like, oh no. And so the teacher's looking at me like, yeah, I'm never getting invited back to this school. And so I'm quietly just freaking out. And so I quickly pivot to the next question. I'm like, oh, okay, so what's your favorite scene? And this one girl is the only girl who puts up her hand. I'm like, oh no, someone else please. And no one else puts up their hand. So I take her answer. And she's like, oh, I really, really like that scene when the gay kid loses his virginity to another boy. And I'm like, oh no. And I'm like, yeah, this is it. I'm done. But by this point, I'm like, you know what? I'm really curious why I assumed this girl was heterosexual. I was like, why on earth, you know, did that scene speak to her the most? And I asked her and she was like, oh, it was because I read it and I understood my friend Sam a little bit better. And that's the really funny thing is when we talk about sort of talking about gay themes in high schools and in schools in general, we sort of worry about it being a sort of instruction manual as if we are going to convert everyone to being gay. But really, it's about teaching people empathy. And this girl, through my book, understood her gay best friend a little bit better. And that's the thing, I was never going to, even if I didn't come out professionally, I wasn't going to not write gay characters because that's part of our world. And I saw the good that doing that could do. And, you know, now that I've seen the good that can come out of either writing queer characters or of coming out, then no, I'm not going to go back and change anything because, you know, I've seen the positives that can come from it.
So why now? Why is now the time that you decided to, you know, to use that metaphor from before, uncork the bottle? Like, why is now the time to go back and look at how you felt and how you feel now about your friend?
Because I was forgetting him. I couldn't wait any longer because I may have become a better writer, but I was forgetting that experience. And one of the big things that drove me to write young adult novels was because I was so close to being a young adult and so close to understanding how it felt and how I felt then. And the thing is, there will come a time in 5, 10, 15 years where writing for young adults will be a lot harder. And there are already those times where I go to speak at a school and kids start talking to me and I'm like, I have no idea what words you just used. And sort of, it takes a lot of effort to sort of stay current. I knew it was just the right time to get it off my chest. I think I'm just good enough a writer, but also those memories are still fresh. And because I don't want to write about it as a, you know, 28-year-old reflecting back. I want to emulate that sort of feeling of being a 16, 17-year-old as best as I possibly can.
What kind of memories do you want to make sure you have with you when you write about it now?
Obviously, the good times, but also the times of just crippling insecurity. Like, you know, it was one of those friendships where I never quite felt at peace in, whether it was because I was hiding a significant part of myself or whether he liked to keep us all on our toes and it was like, you know, an episode of Survivor where we could be eliminated at any moment and be kicked out of the friendship group. But I wanted to sort of capture that, you know, raw insecurity of being a teenager and, you know, having someone who's such an important part of your life who you really love and care for. But also the fact that, you know, as teenagers, we treat our best friends horribly sometimes. And I wanted to capture the good and the bad.
Were there particular moments that stood out to you that from your own life that you wanted to include?
So for me, it was, I actually, so what happened was in grade 10, instead of sort of sticking to an English syllabus, our teacher, we rushed through all the texts we had to read for the year. And then for the rest of the year, we made a film. A student film, and I fancied myself to be a little M. Night Shyamalan. And so I was like, right, I'm going to write this, direct it, produce it, you know, edit it, you know, I'm going to do absolutely everything. And, you know, the product was a really, really terrible film. But I chose to work with my friends because I knew they would just say yes to everything I wanted and let me do all the work. And it got to the point where making the film was a really painful experience because they hated being around me because I was devoted to making the most perfect film, but they were devoted to making the best blooper reel. And those two aims, you know, they're not compatible. So we were constantly in conflict. And after he passed away, I was left with all this raw footage of him saying he hated, you know, filming with me between takes and all these sort of candid moments. And I really, really wanted to capture sort of what it was like to trawl through those hours and hours of raw footage as, you know, a teenager who was grieving. And yet I had recorded, you know, these instances where my friend said he hated me. And obviously that was just a very, very, very small sliver of our friendship. And, you know, but devoid of context, it was something that was quite brutal to me when I was still grieving. And I was mature enough, I think, at the time to sort of be like, okay, that was a small part of who we were. And I sort of set it aside. And when I was writing The Sidekicks, I was like, okay, but what if that footage really, really affected the way that I grieved? And what if I started to believe all the horrible things that he said that I had recorded? Because I didn't have recordings of all the positive things that we said and did for each other. And so that was one of the big things I really wanted to capture.
Yeah, that must have been really difficult for that to be one of the ways to remember each other. But then again, on the other hand, you did say that, like, the dark, aggressive comedy was the way that you related. So yeah. I don't know. Did having that sort of a hostile footage, do you think, like, that's kind of a way he would have wanted you to remember him?
Oh, yeah, he would be cackling wildly at the thought that that was all I had to remember him by. But, yeah, and I can still see the humor in it. And, you know, it's still, and there's still sort of, that's how I relate to the, I still haven't learned the lesson. I still say, you know, my friends and I all relate to each other by saying really horrible things to each other, but we say it with love.
Now that you've written this book about your memory of that time, have you found that it changes the way you look back on it? Like, has it changed the way that you feel about that time in your life?
I don't think it's changed the way I look at it, but I see it in the context of my life and how it's made me who I am. And now, obviously, you know, I've seen the benefits of it. I mean, I got a book deal because I wrote about his funeral. And I was a really shy, really reserved kid in high school. But after he passed away, I was forced to come out of my shell. And so I have seen and written about in the Sidekicks the positives that can come from such a negative sort of experience. But at the same time, I would take all of those positives, roll them into a ball, toss them back just to have him back here. And so it's sort of, it hasn't changed the way that I look at it, but I can see that event in the context of my entire life. And I'm looking back at it now with 10 years distance. And I sort of see that the role it played in shaping me and shaping who I am.
What would you want to tell that you of this 10 years ago? Like, what advice would you have had for yourself?
Oh, I would just tell myself to be less afraid because, you know, it was, there was that big shock after my best friend passed away and sort of I had to rebuild myself, but I still rebuilt myself with those walls intact. And it took me another 5 or 6 years to, you know, knock the rest of them down and to really start being open about who I am and my sexuality and things like that. And that still feels like wasted time. So I would go back to that younger version of myself and say, look, yeah, it's total garbage that, you know, your mates died, but you need to see it as a wake-up call that, you know, no tomorrow is guaranteed and you need to live for you, not for someone else, not to preserve some perception of yourself that you think is what people want, because at the end of the day, you are the only person who has to be comfortable with your life.
So what do you think the you of 10 years ago would think of the way that you're living openly now?
I'm sure it would scare him, but it's also a very different world. To, you know, I say it, it sounds really weird when I verbalize it, but it's true. We live in a post-Glee world. I don't know when it aired in the US, but in Australia, Glee was on prime time at 7:30 on a major network. And that's something that a lot of people my age and younger grew up on. And it's, we can talk a lot about, you know, the quality of the storytelling, but it really, you know, made being gay less controversial. It wasn't used for stunts. It was just a part of, you know, the diverse tapestry of the schools that it represented. And so I think the younger version of me, you know, without knowing that, would think, oh, okay, that's a bit bold. But I think the younger version of me would be relieved. Because I don't think even in my younger self's wildest dreams, he would have seen me where I am now. And I don't mean professionally, but I just mean at peace with myself and open with those around me.
So you said that this is the this book is going to be your US debut. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little about how that's been going so far.
It's really interesting. Like I have no idea what to expect. It's, you know, I have all these authors around me who've told me, oh, once our books went to the US, they were completely gutted. You know, all the Australianisms were taken out. I was forced to change all these things. I've been lucky in my experience where I didn't have to change my novel very much for an American audience. I had, even though this is the first book that's being published over there, I have a small but devoted fan base in the United States who would import my work. But overall, it's been really lovely to see this story that I thought was very small and very Australian be embraced by people overseas.
So what is the, I guess, U.S. tour going to look like for you? Like, how does it roll out in the U.S.?
So in terms of, so the book is released on October 17th, and in terms of a tour, it looks very intense. Like, an Australian book tour is like, okay, you might visit 2 cities and maybe meet about 30 people all up. This is about 2 weeks intensive, almost a different city every single day. I think there are about, you know, 2 conferences, you know, 5 or 6 bookstore appearances, things like that. And honestly, it looks a little terrifying, but every sort of author I know who's been on one of these tours has just said to sort of just go for the ride. It is draining and intense, but it is the most fun you'll ever have. And all the American readers that I have read, either at that I've met, either, you know, conferences in Australia or just, you know, meeting them in bookstores and things like that, have been some of the most intense, most welcoming readers, and I cannot wait to sort of meet them and, you know, have them engage with my work as well.
Yeah, so tell me about what you're looking forward to. I know there's, you know, like meeting the readers and then sort of like, I don't know, American gay stuff that you're looking forward to seeing.
In terms of just gay stuff in general.
I don't know, like as you're making this, doing this trip, I don't know if you're going to even have any time to just be like, oh, I'm in Oklahoma. What are the gay bars here?
Well, no, that's the thing though. The only time I have, so I love the US. I try to go back almost every year. And the last time I was there, I was in San Francisco. And it's just so different. It's like gay nirvana over there. Like people just, like guys just flirt with you on the street. Like, I don't know if I was in a gay district or not, but I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And it was so warm and so welcoming. And it just, everyone always talks about how conservative some parts of America are, but that's not something that I saw when I was over there. And, yeah, I'm very interested to, I have a lot of, so my publisher is in New York and I have a lot of gay friends in New York. So I'm very excited to spend a couple of days there just being dragged from gay bar to gay bar to karaoke bars and sort of see as much of the gay scene in New York as possible. Is there anything you would recommend I see while I'm there?
I don't know, just in general, like walk around Greenwich Village, go to Stonewall, see, you know, the world that it's possible to have now. I mean, like looking back, you know, like 100 years or so, or even just 50, you know, we're kind of walking in the footsteps of people who had to walk very stealthily, and now we can just wear our rainbows all over our bodies.
Yeah.
So I really enjoy like occupying the echoes of the people who came before us.
Wonderful. I will make sure if I find anything interesting, I let you know.
Perfect. And so if people want to follow along with your tour or connect with you online, where should they go?
Yep. It's just my name on most social media. So it's Will Kostakis, Kostakis. I'm most active on Instagram and Twitter. But yeah, that'd probably be the best way to reach me and to heckle me or support me or to give me, you know, their recommendations of what I should be doing when I'm in their city.
Well, yeah, send your recommendations along to Will, everybody. And Will, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Big thanks to Will for joining me and for speaking and writing so openly about his experiences with pain. We all have built-in survival instincts that turn us away from anything that hurts. Confronting a source of suffering is difficult enough, but then processing it to the point that you're ready to share it with others is a brutally difficult and courageous task. For my recommendation this week, take a look at David Rakoff's 2001 book, Fraud. I can't believe it's taken me this long to recommend the book. Front to back, it's one of my favorite pieces of writing. It's a series of essays, all lush and hilarious, but also frayed at the edges with pain, like a leaf starting to turn color. The whole book is a masterpiece, but every time I read it, I find myself tingling with anticipation of its final two paragraphs. We've just spent 225 pages with David, accompanying him on bizarre adventures to yoga retreats, posing as Freud in a shopping mall window, and to Loch Ness, and the whole time he feels like a detached imposter. Sometimes he wears a disguise, sometimes he places a pane of sarcasm between himself and his subjects, and always he establishes an emotional remove. But on the last page of the book, after describing the period in his life when he nearly died from lymphoma, he asks, "What remains of your past if you didn't allow yourself to feel it when it happened? If you don't have your experiences in the moment, if you gloss over them with jokes or zoom past them, you end up with curiously dispassionate memories." David passed away in 2012 when his lymphoma returned, and I think about the words at the end of this book a lot. That survival instinct that we all have to turn away from pain, to avoid it or decorate it or disguise it, that impulse can keep us alive, but it can also keep us from living while we're here. Thanks again for listening. Remember to get your tickets to our Dungeons & Drag Queens show here in Seattle. We sold out last time. Go to StrangerTickets.com to make sure you'll be able to get in. If you're enjoying The Sewers of Paris, head over to SewersOfParis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon to pledge $1 or more per episode. Huge thanks to all the patrons who keep the show going. And you can also leave a review on iTunes. That is super helpful. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Facebook. Just search for The Sewers of Paris. And I love to hear from listeners. You can write in at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.